you haven't slept well, your mind wanders more the next day. So it might be that you're trying to compensate for that in some way.
Oh, that is, yeah, that is actually very, like, I mean, who knows what the, I mean, I don't want to say who knows, but, like, I'm obviously not sure of, like, the correlation, but I guess this brings up, like, kind of what we were saying, this idea that, like, mind wandering might have some sort of, like, relationship to dreaming in, like, its functionality or whatever, or, like, the kind of causal relationships between the two is something I did not think about, but could honestly kind of make sense. It's like, I mean, it used to be called daydreaming.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, one of my studies, we asked people it's almost like I like to think about it as like a daydream journal. So when we ask you if your mind is wandering, we also ask, what was it wandering about? And it reminds me of like when you have a dream journal, like a night dream journal, when you wake up, you write your dreams down. And I always pilot the study myself to kind of see what it's like to be the participant. And so I went through the study where it goes through your phone. So periodically throughout the day, you get like a message on your phone asking if your mind is wandering and then what your most recent train of thought was. I found the act of writing out my daydreams made them clearer in my mind. It's similarly to how when you wake up from a dream and you write your dreams down, you start to remember them better. They become more clear when you're having them. You can start to lucid dream, for example. And actually, there's a parallel to lucid dreaming in mind wandering. Like your mind, you can. It's called meta awareness, so it's like awareness of awareness. And the idea is, your mind can be wandering, but you don't know what it's wandering, which is like crazy. And that's mind wandering without awareness. But you can also have mind wandering with awareness too. And I think I like to think about that as being like a corollary with lucid dreaming. So an interesting avenue of research would be to see if people who write their mind wanderings down, if they then do mind wandering with awareness more as a result of that.
And so lucid dreaming is where one is aware that they're dreaming as they're dreaming.
Yeah.
Now, as strange as it seems, would it seem that most forms of mind wandering, would you consider it that people are actually unawares in the moment that they are mind wandering?
Yeah, well, the classic study was I forget exactly how it worked, but I think basically there's two ways to catch mind wandering in the lab. You can do probe caught or self-caught. So self-caught mind wandering is you say when you've noticed your mind has wandered, press the button, and then probe caught is periodically they'll ask you, is your mind wandering? And they found that even though they were asking people to self-catch, people still were probe. The probe was still catching them. So in other words, you're only intermittently aware that your mind is wandering. And I don't know what the percentage is. That's an interesting question. I would guess it's not good. Like I think because it takes a lot of cognitive resources to monitor your own thoughts. So I think that's why they speculate in the literature. Like that's why we're not always aware that our mind is wandering, because it's costly to do that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
the brain uses up a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, it makes a lot of sense that we've only, because you mentioned before, or like at the start of the show, that it's really only recently that we've been starting to study it, or that we like have the means of like quantifying this or something like that. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because mind wandering is like a self-effacing phenomena in that way. And it also it's in a certain way, it makes it distinct from things like imagining or like, you know, creative imagination and then like following a thought specifically from that, because that's like on track in a certain way, whereas mind wandering is, it's almost like constituted by a certain lack of awareness. And this also goes back to what you were saying about dreaming and the way that as you start documenting a dream, it actually like kind of changes or amplifies the dream that you had. You start, you know, remembering more about the dream. So even as you like try to study mind wandering, or the particular contents of it. So it makes a lot of sense that it would, like with a probe study or something, it's more or less like catching the instance, because if you ask people to articulate their mind wandering, you're going to get more than was really going on. So it's a very like self-effacing phenomena in that sense.
Self-effacing meaning it causes us to confront aspects of ourselves that we don't
Don't
want to see. Is that what you mean?
By self-effacing, I mean that it kind of, as soon as you try and take its picture, you know, you take the photo and then you look at the photo and it's gone, right? Like you can't really like, the more you look at it, the more it kind of goes away, right? And that's what makes it difficult to study, is even if you can quantify it, the like particular content is going to shift on its quantification or something like that.
Yeah, totally. It's funny. I would ask participants in my study to reflect on what it was like, and a lot of them, I think, found it frustrating because, I ask you, to what degree was your mind freely moving, for example, and I think people didn't feel confident in their answers. And I think it's particularly with freely moving thought, because you have to think back to know if your mind is freely moving. You have to be able to see, well, like, what were the different topics that it was on? How closely related are those topics? And you have to, I feel like, have a pretty good grasp on your mind to do that. For example, there's this recent distinction that's come about. They call it feelings. I think it's called subjective feelings of inattention versus remembered mind wandering. Anyway, basically it just comes down to the fact that we often can't even remember what our minds were wondering about. We have this feeling that our mind is wandering, but we can't actually recall it. And it's brand new. Like, there's only been like 2 studies done on it, but one of them found that it was related to ADHD, which is really interesting. And a bunch of other mental health issues, related to mental health, like sleep disturbances and stuff like that. So
I definitely have had times where in the middle of the day, I'll see something that triggers like a dream association that I had the night before, but I don't remember the dream. I just know that there's an association there. So that's interesting.
You know, I think, Brandon, this is kind of like a little bit, or it inspired me to kind of think about this, what you were saying, particularly about the self-effacing component. I'm not super well versed in psychoanalysis, but there is something that's coming up to me, which is like, to what degree, like looking at things maybe from an older view, do we see like mind wandering as part of like the subconscious, like mental self, in the sense of like when we actually, you know, try that more like the more aware kind of thinking, as I was kind of saying, like when you try and pin down mind wandering, when you go, oh, I'm daydreaming right now, I'm mind wandering right now, try to pin it down, what am I thinking about, it starts to sort of kind of slip and slither away from us. But when we kind of like go hands off and just sort of like let stuff happen, suddenly this stuff starts to sort of like bubble to the surface a little bit.
Yeah, people talk about like the muse, like there's, it's as though like you have a creative idea and people attach all this like spiritual significance to it, because it does seem like it's comes from something outside of us. But yeah, it could very well just be that we didn't do it, but it's because of it's like some unconscious processes. I think that what do they say, like your conscious mind is like a very slim proportion of actually what goes on in your mind. And so your unconscious is actually much more powerful. So yeah, I think mind wandering does kind of tap into that resource, because I think when you're thinking in a goal-directed way, you know why you think each thought, because you're consciously, deliberately producing each thought. But mind wandering, it's like, where the heck did that come from? You know, and I think that's why it can be a source for creativity, because, I don't know, that's what I find. Like when I've, generally speaking, when I have a really good idea, it happens when like I'm in the shower or something, and I'm not thinking about, it's like, it's, I'm working on a thing, and then I get frustrated and I step away. And it's usually when I'm just like relaxing, like making dinner or something like that, it comes.
That's interesting. I was, because initially when you, so I wasn't aware of this distinction between that kind of like runs throughout psychology of task related and task unrelated stuff. And I kind of like immediately thought of like a problematizing case, and it's, and maybe this isn't mind wandering because it's like kind of intentional, but I think this is what makes it an interesting case now that we're like talking about creativity a little bit. And it's the technique that the artist Salvador Dali would use to come up with ideas. And what he would do is he would just go like sunbathe in a lawn chair, and he would be holding a stopwatch very lightly. And as he's like going into these thoughts and coming up with things, he would relax and become tired. And then he would drop the stopwatch, and that would, you know, shock him out of the daydream or whatever he was thinking about, and then he would go and produce art based on that. It's interesting. I think it problematizes the task related and task unrelated, because in a certain way it's task unrelated because you're not really directing it, but at the same time it's task related because you kind of elected to do this. You know, you're an artist, this is a component of doing the job. This is part of the process. So I wonder if that actually is like because in philosophy we like to change concepts and challenge ideas and stuff like that. I wonder if that's actually like a problem for the distinction, or is that like, does it seem more task related or task unrelated is what Salvador Dali is doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you say is makes sense. There's been a lot of people have made that case, actually, that you can problematize that distinction quite easily, which is interesting because that is primarily how mind wandering is defined in the literature. But yeah, that's, I mean, I guess you could say what Salvador Dali is doing is task related in the sense that he's trying to have an idea, but it's sort of vague. Like it's like, he doesn't really know what that idea is going to be. It's undirected. So I think that the freely moving thought people would say that, that would count as mind wandering, whereas the task related people would say that it wouldn't. So yeah, whereas I think intuitively we would think that that would be more like mind wandering. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, because it does, on the one case, it seems like mind wandering. This is like maybe a case where the distinction between daydreaming and mind wandering might be a useful distinction.
Right. Well, yeah, daydreaming, I think, is more directed and intentional. That's something that, Hale, you asked me earlier, like what are the kind of more recent developments? Well, there's this guy, Paul Celi, who he reintroduced this distinction, which I think was present in the 70s in mind wandering research, the little of it that was going on back then, between intentional and unintentional mind wandering. But people get upset about that. So like, how can you mind wander intentionally? It seems like a contradiction. And actually a guy wrote a philosophy paper on why you get this dilemma. Like either if you want to acknowledge the existence of intentional mind wandering, you have to either redefine what mind wandering, like you either have to abandon this notion of task unrelated thought counting as mind wandering, or you have to say that what you're doing is not mind wandering. It's like some goal directed process. If it's task if it's intentional, it's therefore task related. So you can't think of it as task unrelated thought, or you can, or you can just think of it as goal directed and salvage that definition of mind. But he said basically you have to pick one, and both of them are kind of revolutionary in terms of how we think about these things.
Yeah, and that seems a little bit strange, at least from my like cursory understanding, because like kind of like from a materialist or observational view, like the sort of what you would call it daydreaming, the mind wandering, even if it's like that state is intentionally brought about, it still would look the same. Like I think that example that Brandon brought up of Salvador Dali was honestly really good, because it's like it's an example of someone like intentionally trying to put themselves in that mind wandering state, where intentionality is the exact kind of thing that you're trying to like remove from the mental process. But like once you're in that state, it wouldn't necessarily look any different from that time that Salvador Dali was on the bus, like just looking out the window and just happened to start like, you know, thinking about random stuff like lobster phones and melting clocks.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a valid point if I'm understanding you correctly. I mean, sometimes I like to think of it as a metaphor of like literally wandering. So like you can, because yeah, it does seem like you're basically being intentionally unintentional, I guess. You can think of it as at different time points. So like say you want to wander around a market, like you intentionally walk to the market, but then when you get there, you sort of wander around.
It's like straight up getting lost in the woods versus being like, I'm going to go get lost in the woods. People do that. That's like a thing that they, you know, do because they want to connect with nature or whatever. And they don't want to have a specific path they're sticking to. So they're just going to kind of like lose themselves and get, you know, and wander around. Hopefully not too far. We're definitely not encouraging anyone to go get lost in the woods or a park or anything like that. But it is a little bit different than someone just kind of like stumbling into the woods without any idea of like why they're there. And just being like ineffectively in outright confusion or unintentionality.
Yeah, that's, yeah, totally. And what's interesting is they found that that's a pretty good indicator of your mental health. Like, so if you, so it, intentional wandering is associated with better mental health outcomes, whereas unintentional mind wandering is associated with worse mental health outcomes. And yeah, like anxiety and a few different things, depression, I think.
So what we're saying is that Salvador Dali had extremely good mental health.
That's got to be the conclusion. Yeah. Right? Yeah. He seemed like he had it pretty together.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask too about, because I did want to go into this, area of like mental health and talking about like, well, what is the, because you know, we get asked in philosophy all the time, okay, like what is the point? Well, you know, in psychology we really can we have like measures of like mental health, and we can even like help people with our research and whatnot. My wonder was like, what directions did you have in particular for kind of like relating this to mental health? But I have an idea of like, because you say that intentional mind wandering is kind of like symptomatic of good mental health, and unintentional is symptomatic of like bad mental health. That makes a lot of sense to me. One thing I'm curious about is the pattern of the content of mind wandering. I suspect that people who have like a varied, or at least like a non kind of like, I don't know how to put it, but like kind of a varied like mental life versus people who have like almost this ruminative style or like consistent and like frequently repetitive like contents to their mind wandering. I suspect those individuals would have like poor mental health outcomes because maybe there's like something that it shows that they're struggling with or something like that. But one thing I'm curious about, but I'd also just leave it open to you about how your, like what your interest in the intersection between mind wandering and mental health is.
Yeah, well, that is, I think it makes sense intuitively that people who have more of, like, so what they say in the literature is a distinction between like constrained and unconstrained, which basically is the same thing as freely moving versus not. And so you would think that people whose minds don't move freely would be more prone to mental health problems, because that sounds like rumination. But one thing that's been really interesting that's come out recently is they found, if anything, it's the opposite. So people that are more prone to unconstrained, well, it's pretty early days. Like it's, I think that's really actually only been one study. I mean, the thing is like the dynamic framework would predict that freely moving thoughts associated with positive mental health outcomes, which actually makes sense too, because what my focus is that it's related to positive affect. But what they've found is if at the very least, so far anyway, there's no relationship. And if there's a relationship, it goes the other way. So yeah, like they found that OCD is associated with more unconstrained thought. And then depression as well in one study. And yeah, and it's funny because I think there's this inclination where it's like, we got to throw out the dynamic framework. And it certainly doesn't fare well. And it's funny because the paper that put forward the dynamic framework has like thousands of citations. Like it's extremely influential. Yeah. And somebody who I was very excited by that kind of framework, that was like discouraging for me to see. It's funny how sometimes we think of scientists as being like these automata that are like, look at the data and then they see the data and then they change their mind. But really scientists are just like anybody else. And we have our own pet theories that we don't want to let go of and stuff like that. But I think that there is a way to potentially, this is completely untested. This is what I actually want to look at in my current study, which I've realized after the fact I have the data to look at. So it has to end up being an exploratory hypothesis. My theory, this is like my pet theory, I have no idea if this is true or not, but my theory is that you can reconcile the dynamic framework with these findings that would seem to challenge it by thinking that there's like, I like to think of, so if you're going to get caught in a ruminative cycle, it's like a two-step process. First, you have to wander around the space of potential thoughts so that you can fall, let's say, into the gravitational pull of a unresolved personal concern. And then you need the predisposition towards rumination to get yourself stuck there. So I think that's the way to look at it. I think it's overly simplistic to just think that somebody is either high in unconstrained thought or low in unconstrained thought. You have to factor in rumination as well. Yeah, we're complex creatures. We're not unidimensional. So anyway, my current study, I can actually test that, but I only thought of it after I'd already started collecting data. So I can't make it what's called a confirmatory. It has to be exploratory. So I have to report it. If I, God willing, if I get my research published, I have to report it as exploratory. So, but it can provide a reason to test it further.
It's super interesting. And the fact that you're doing the research on this is in itself is just fascinating. With our last few minutes, you know, you're currently working on your honors at VIU, if I'm correct, and that's part of your, the studies that you've been running. I guess what is the kind of like ideal research or areas of study? You already mentioned one that you would want to, like, where you would want this to end up or what you would want this to look like in the long term. Like, if you could really, say you end up being, like, Nate the professor and you've got lots of resources, you're at UBC, you've got all sorts of stuff at your disposal. Like, what is the kind of, like, ideal research that you would want to be doing if you had all of that available to you and kind of, like, were able to reach that level?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm interested in, now I'm a pretty curious guy, so there's a lot of different directions I can see myself going. But if I could do anything, one thing that's quite difficult to do ethics-wise is look at like psychedelics on treatment-resistant depression, because I think that there's some kind of theoretical work that thinks that or tries to argue that one of the reasons why psychedelics might be helpful for people with treatment-resistant depression is, like I was just kind of saying, about this like gravitational pull to these unresolved personal concerns, it might lessen that. So in other words, it may allow for more freely moving thought so that you can, like if you look at, I think that they've shown that if you take psychedelics and then you go to therapy, let's say, you can talk about your problems more easily without getting pulled into these ruminative cycles. So it might be that psychedelics allow, and this is, I don't actually know that much about this area, but the little that I've read is you might be able to explore these things in a more reflective way where you're not getting pulled into like these terrible thought loops where it's like, I'm a terrible person. Like you can examine these issues without that. So that there's this thing called the think aloud paradigm where you just get somebody to sit in a room, and then they just, and then there's a microphone in front of them, and they just voice their thoughts. And then you can, like I was saying earlier about the semantic differences between these different thoughts, you can look at, like you could give, I think they've done a study like that, actually. They've given people psychedelics, and then they've, maybe they haven't, I forget. But you give them psychedelics, and then you ask them to voice their thoughts. And I think that what they found is that there's more semantic difference between them. Like your mind wanders more freely. And it might be that people with treatment-resistant depression. So I guess another thing is in these think-aloud paradigms, if somebody has a predisposition towards rumination, you can see them get pulled into those thought loops around these unresolved personal concerns.
The people with those interests or that kind of field would kind of talk about it, like having like a realization that allows their kind of like themselves to sort of decouple from these like thought loops that they continually get stuck in. It's almost like being able to put, you know, the topic of the thought loops or whatever, the focus of them, being able to kind of put them to bed in some sort of level and like really examine them and sort of, you know, kind of put them away just like you would any other event that's happened or idea or thing that you focused on, instead of being this thing that's constantly being the center point of this sort of like rumination cycle that's constantly going on. Nate, I really want to thank you for being our guest. This has been super interesting. We've been talking with Nate about mind wandering and some of the research that he's been doing at Vancouver Island University. And we wish you all the best in your future studies and any future research. And hopefully you come on again at the show. This has been a great discussion. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, Canada. Thank you.